It's the 2nd of November, and I'm in the office of Dr. Pradeep Ray Chaudhuri. I'm not always quite sure I've got the accents on your last name right, but I know I'm doing the CH part of it, pronouncing that right, at least now. But I wanted to start off today with a couple of questions, or several questions from yesterday's session. And to start off with, I wanted to ask, did your father ever, like, take you into his office or pharmacy and, you know, introduce you to chemistry or anything like that with his own profession?
Yes, a lot.
Okay.
A lot. In fact, in summer vacation, I spent a lot of time with him when I was, you know, in schools, so not after I finished school, before.
Yeah. And what did he let you do?
He let me watch. Often I helped him doing things. You know, I learned how to measure, use the measuring cylinder, and then things like that. What is a cc, a milliliter, things like that. I learned from him how to measure those things. I learned that it is important to be very accurate when you do things. It's at that stage, in fact, I learned that it's so important that when you're preparing a medicine for a patient, you have to be following the perceived protocol really accurately. Mm. So, I spent quite a bit of time with him. At points, I also helped him doing things.
Mm. And how did you see this? Did you see it? Did you enjoy it? Or did you see more health-related issues or more chemistry coming out of
it? Oh, it was more chemistry. I didn't understand the health part at all.
Okay. Yeah. Of course, he probably wanted you to understand the health part of it.
Well, that was actually too early. And yeah. I'm talking about when I was like, you know, 9, 10-year-old, 11-year-old, yeah.
Okay. And we didn't talk about it too much. You talked about your grandparents, but did you have an extended family that you saw often in Calcutta, cousins, perhaps aunts and uncles?
Yes. My father had, I have to say had, 7 brothers. I think 2 of them are still alive. Mm-hmm. In fact, the oldest brother is still alive. He is 30 years older than my father, and my father is 78 now, and he's still alive.
Well, this is the side that had the 112-year-old.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And did you interact with these cousins much, or this extended family?
Yes, you know, in family occasions, yeah. Like you know, like weddings, and mostly weddings, we used to get together a lot. But I stopped doing that after I started going to college, and then kind of reduced those things. And I cannot tell you why.
Yeah. Okay, well, we can get back into how much you keep in contact with your family in India a little bit later when we talk about more current things. Another question I wanted to ask is, did your sect, or however you want to describe it, your religious group you identified with in India, have a particular name?
Yes, they go by the name of it's not going to be easy for you to. It's called Akhando Mundoli, there are two words.
Okay, well, I can get the spelling afterwards, but I just thought it would be interesting.
There's a name, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Just to give us an idea how organized this is. You know, somebody may be very interested in knowing that information. And then finally, to move up a little bit more towards the end of the last session, you had mentioned that your English language skills, American language skills, were you had a difficulty to begin with. And how did you bring your language skills up to speed? And how did you have any formal language training in English in India? And did you have to take the test of the English language exam that most foreign students have to take?
Right. Well, you know, we learn English as a second language. So I could write English. I could read English this as good as any American. But the accent was a big difficulty for me. And then took me a while to learn that. I learned it mostly from my roommates, by talking to them, by trying to understand them. And that was and also maybe radio and then TV, those things helped. But mostly from my roommates.
Yeah.
Often they corrected me way I used to pronounce them before, and then they corrected my pronunciation a lot.
Okay. Well, one of the last things you mentioned yesterday when we talked about was I wanted to put this into some kind of context, that you had mentioned that you felt like your thinking was very narrow at the time you were doing your work in Maitra's lab, and that you were focusing really on the mechanisms of protein synthesis rather than maybe looking at a much more general issue of cell development, cell proliferation. But at the time, and given that you were working very heavily in an enzymology setting, and that this is the mid-80s when a lot of the techniques, molecular techniques, are just beginning to be exploited, and there was so much knowledge to learn. You know, how much was this just a product, this narrow thinking, was a product of, you know, your environment as opposed to, you know, not seeing the bigger picture at the time?
You're right. It is not seeing the bigger picture. That's not true. I had in mind doing research in cancer. My PhD training was, where I see now, is learning the skills, you know, learning skills, how to do science,
mm-hmm.
the technicalities, the details of it. Those are the things I learned. In fact, learned very well at that time. And I learned by looking at a very narrow, very specific thing, very focused, and just one thing. And I felt that I did not, because the field was somewhat narrow, it was a narrow field, protein synthesis, because you do not need to read about many other things if you're working on this subject. It doesn't allow you to think of other things because of the nature of the topic. And as a result, I felt that I was working on a narrow area of research. And maybe that was the comment I was trying to make yesterday. And then, because of that, I felt that I am deficient compared to others. who are involved in a broader area of research. I did get that feeling near the end of my thesis work. And that probably helped me or made, you know, the change that I went through at that point, or transition I went through, was probably a result of that understanding that I'm not learning a lot other than trying to do one thing.
Okay. Well, and to go on a little bit, to look at your own kind of the development, your own identity as a scientist, you had mentioned that even before you left India that you were interested in working on cancer biology because this was like mankind's difficult problem to solve. And at the end of your PhD work, you still want to work in cancer. And how was this, what was your idea? How was your idea of what doing good science in cancer research transformed from, like, you know, your ideas as a pre-grad student wanting to do cancer, and then going into your first postdoctoral experience still wanting to do cancer? Like, how did it change, or how did it stay the same?
Well, as I said, from protein synthesis, you know, it is less directly related to cancer. So I wanted to do something which is more directly related to cancer. That's why I picked this lab to do my postdoctoral studies in the Nevin's lab. What he was studying is viral oncogenes. These are powerful tools to study how a normal cell is converted to a tumor cell. Because if you just take one of these oncogenes and introduce into this normal cell, they acquired the phenotype of a cancer cell. So that was a very simple system, and I thought that would something I would be interested in, and that I would be able to learn a lot by studying that. And in fact, that's what I did. During my postdoctoral studies, I studied a viral oncogene, and I discovered a lot in terms of how this oncogene is converting a normal cell to a cancer cell.
Okay. Well, had you thought by, you know, identifying that you wanted to move away from anything associated with being an entomologist to moving into the field of virology, had you identified any other areas that you possibly could do research in cancer in, and had you looked at any other labs to do besides the Nevin's lab?
Yes, I was, you know, I was, as I said, I was offered by many labs a postdoctoral position. The person who was very interested was actually at Rockefeller, which is Robert Rader, Bob Rader's lab. And he actually offered me a lot, more than he offers to an average postdoc. And I realized that would be continuation of enzymology. He was trying to recruit me because of my expertise in enzymology. He was, at that point, purifying transcription factors important in mRNA synthesis. That's an important area, and I looked into it very seriously. I considered his lab very seriously. But it appeared to me Nevin's lab would be more appropriate and more directly linked to my interest, what that was at that point. It was a difficult choice because Bob Rader is a very senior established person at that point. He was a National Academy member at that point, and then whereas Nevins was simply an associate professor at that time, and then there's a big difference in their status. But Nevins was young, and then he was very impressive at that point. He was doing very good science, and then I decided to go to his lab. There are other labs I was offered, but I was not sure about those labs. Also, I wanted to stay in New York because of my wife. She was in New York, so I didn't want to get out of New York, so that would have been difficult.
Right. Okay. Well. Okay. Why don't we pursue this like a little bit, since you didn't come to the United States married?
No.
Okay.
No.
So, and now within 4 years you have a wife. So maybe we can put a little bit of a personal context back in the story. Had you, and we've talked off tape that she's a scientist as well. So how did you meet?
Wayne Einstein. In Einstein, when I was a graduate student.
Okay.
Yeah.
And was she a graduate student or postdoc?
She was a postdoc.
Postdoc. In the same lab?
No, in a different lab.
Yeah, okay. And so you were pretty much committed to staying in New York City. Were you married by this time?
We got married right after my thesis defense, so...
Yeah, yeah.
And we knew that she was going to stay there because she was very comfortable in that position she had over there at that point.
Okay.
And she didn't want to move, although we ended up moving after a year. And then Nevins made a very nice offer to her.
Okay. To continue or start a new postdoc
in
his lab at Duke.
Right.
Okay. Well, so it just basically meant from moving from the Bronx down to the East Side. Okay. Well, we can get back and talk about that, because you do end up collaborating with your wife on several important papers. But to pick up with the Nevins lab, and so how did you bring yourself up to speed into this new field for you of virology, and clearly a lab that is moving and shaking, so to speak, at the Rockefeller?
Right. It was, again, it was hard work, and then the zeal to get there. And that's all I can say about that. And I would say that within a year, I published a good paper, which has nothing to do with enzymology. And so that tells that, how speedily I moved at that point, and I'm learning things and I'm doing things. That's all I can say.
Okay. And... to talk a little bit about your work that, culminates in a series of interesting and important papers in PNAS and Cell. When you started in the Nevins lab, how did you choose to work on the E1A gene and the E2F transcription factor? Was his lab already geared to study adenoviruses? Mechanisms.
Yes, that's somewhat interesting. In fact, his interest was he was running two main projects. One is this, studying this viral oncogene. The other project was 3' end processing of messenger RNA, okay, which involved isolating factors. And his interest was that I would work on that project. And I was very clear what I was going to work on. And so I mentioned to him clearly that I think that that's again a narrow field of research. I spent about 5 years doing that type of work, and I do not want to do this. Right. That was, it was not very pleasant to him in that afternoon when he realized that I'll be doing these things. But, you know, he is nice, and he accepted it within a week that I would be doing things. And he started talking with me about projects.
Okay. And so why did you choose to work on the E1A?
Yeah, well, as I said, E1A is an oncogene, and this oncogene has been described to convert a normal cell to a tumor cell. And then that was my interest, and then it was very obvious for me to study that, and then
yeah, okay. Well, if you look at your papers in basically in sequential order, like I did, it looks like you know, you pursue one logical conclusion to the next. But how clear was it at the time when you were working early on that to understand the E1A mechanisms of the transcriptional process, that there were other cellular factors involved? And how much, you know, was it basically you knew that from the gels that there was something else there, and how much was it a hunting expedition, say, to identify the E4F factor versus you were looking basically at the mechanisms of viral oncogenes and how they transform normal cells and happened to stumble across that, you know, there are these several other factors involved?
Right. No, in fact, it was actually both of them. Partly it was hunting, like hunting for a factor that's regulated by E1A. The logic is to find something in cell that is a target of E1A, and then do genetics on E1A. We know what region of E1A protein is involved in transformation, to see whether those region of E1A molecule are also important to target the cellular protein. So you're right, it was both, trying to identify cellular targets. And then knowing what we know about E1A's transforming function, trying to link those to these target to see whether that's an important target or not. For example, if there are regions in E1A molecule which are not important for transformation, if that region is involved in this target, then we know this target is not important for transformation, at least from that analysis. And then so we can decide and then go on to find other more interesting targets that might be directly linked to the transforming ability of E1A. So E4F work was, at that time there was this E2F factor identified in the lab. So obviously the feeling that there are other factors like E2F might be regulated by E1A, can we find them? And this was hunting for a factor that might be, you know, changing its level or activity as a function of E1A was within my expertise at that point. And I did this type of work during protein synthesis. So I thought I should be able to identify something, and I did. The E4F factor, there's another postdoc who joined the lab at the same time, Robert Rooney. He and I started on this together, sort of. We took a new approach at that point to identify factors. Because the approach was new, Joe thought that maybe both of us can start together and then divide it later on.
Find enough factors that would keep you all fairly busy.
Right. We found one factor, E4F, and then what I decided to do after a year and a half of work, that he probably can continue working on that, because E2F, the stories on E2F was becoming very interesting, and then I kind of shifted to E2F slowly.
Well, how much at the time when you were looking, you know, at the E4F, how much of the knowledge at the time you were starting this E4F project, that the E2F project was looking like it was a much more complicated story than originally thought?
See, what I used to do, or what I used to, I do not know where I grew this, or I cannot tell you how I grew this. It's something that I used to talk to everybody in the lab, find out what they are doing, try to help them. And this I did a lot. At a point, like 75% of Nabin's lab, I used to run that lab for those postdocs. So what it is my was that my interest on the projects, and I could see that this E2F factor had a lot more potential. And so I myself slowly got involved. So it is the interactions. And the people I interacted in Nabin's lab, they found it very helpful, because they got a lot of help from me. And as a result, I could see the big thing, what is the important thing, and then I slowly shifted to the thing that I thought more important at the moment.
How big was Nevin's lab at this point?
At that point, he probably had, well, the lab total people were like about 20 people, and there were probably like 14 or 15 postdocs and several technicians and a couple graduate students.
And when did it be, and to put this into a broader context, when did you make the jump from looking at this as viral oncogenes to maybe a completely different mechanism of tumor suppressor genes?
It was not a jump, actually.
Okay.
It was a simply logical flow.
Simply logical. Okay. I'm going to ask you to explain that, because
about that time, Robert Weinberg and Ed Harlow, they published a paper showing that E1A binds tumor suppressor, RB tumor suppressor protein. What we were studying are actually transcription factors which are regulated by E1A. And so we're looking at function of E1A that are related to E1A's transforming ability, but they were looking at what protein binds directly to E1A. We were looking at what transcription factors are regulated by E1A. It turns out that the protein that binds to E1A, the tumor suppressor, in fact regulates E2F. So we showed that's how E1A activates this transcription factor, by taking away the tumor suppressor from this. So the story was that this tumor suppressor binds to E2F and shuts down the replication genes. So what oncogene is doing, taking these protein away. So this factor is now active to stimulate replication genes. So the linking these two involves a little bit of thinking and knowing the area of research. And I would say I was the one in the lab who could link it.
And why was that? I mean, why were you the one? I mean, these aren't easy questions, but
no,
I'd like to pose them anyway.
I do not want to say that the other... It probably the I had a more prepared mind for it. That I was trying to understand, and then I was reading and then thinking that might be this. There were other postdocs who were involved in these studies, and I cannot tell you why it didn't occur to them. But it occurred to me, and then it's the only way I can say probably I had the mind set of which was ready to see that those two are probably linked. And that was a huge discovery, that a paper that I published, actually Sri Lada, my wife, was the first author in the paper, showing how E1A dissociates cellular complex. And because that opened up the area of studying tumor suppressor, and then so many big labs jumped into this and then started working on these factors. In fact, everything followed from that one paper we published on how E1A dissociates a cellular complex of this transcription factor, and then identifying those proteins that or studying the mechanism of dissociation, then we start seeing that these are all tumor suppressors.
And what were you thinking at the time that you were getting these results? In terms of, one, intellectually and scientifically, and your idea of always wanting to do good science.
Right.
But on the other hand, also this issue of fame. You know, being a scientist it means a little bit of, you know, being famous or having kind of a personal stake in what happens. So when you were getting these results, you had the idea, and, you know, the results are proving your idea. What were you thinking in terms of, God, you know, I really want to do good science and do work in cancer biology. At the same time, I really want to be a good scientist, and part of that is personal fame, or, you know.
No, well, yeah.
Say famous,
no.
You know, but... that people do need to have to go get jobs
right.
After their postdoc.
Right, so personal fame does not come into that picture at that point.
Okay.
When you are a student or postdoc, everybody knows the things that... I used to be very aggressive when you go to meetings and present my work. And so in the area, everybody knows me very well. I present, so that's something I did to earn fame, if that's what you're asking, and that is go to meetings and present my work and then show off, and then that's all I did. But when I was doing this work, trying to make these discoveries, it was painful work. It was trying to show, and then once you develop an idea, a new idea is just often difficult for other people to accept. Even Nevins had, you know, he didn't accept the idea for several months that how E1A might be involved in dissociating a complex between RB and E2F. It was, he had a different mindset up then, and so it took him a while to accept that. But once he saw it, he saw everything.
And why do you think it took him a while?
It's just because he had, you know, it has to do with the details of E1A. He had this strong feeling that a region of E1A is involved in regulating E2F, And it was known that that region is not involved in binding to tumor suppressors. So it is a lot, it has a lot to do with what, how he felt about the mechanism, the type kind of story he was trying to develop, mm-hmm. and the what was known in the literature. He could not tie them. I had the result. I had the film, the experiment done to link them. But it was not enough at that point to convince that that was it. But it had the look of you know, it has it. I don't know how to explain it. It's like. Like you show that this is, you can see a door, an opening. He didn't see it for a while. And that was somewhat frustrating for me. It took me several months to convince. But then he came back to me once, telling me that this is what might be going on. So that was kind of interesting.
And how did you convince him that this was really the case, and then how did you react when, you know, he comes back to you and presents it?
Well, it was, I you know, what, you know, this has happened between us many times, and so before that, and so when this happened, it was like one of those. Both of us kind of took it very easily and friendly. So we, he is a very nice person. He can see if he's wrong. He can see it.
Mm-hmm.
He's extremely bright too. Because once he sees something, he can see far. You know. Quite a bit. That's something I learned from him.
And how would you, okay, so how would you assess your own abilities to be like that with your own students?
I think I have that ability. I do not have his facility. And he knows that. there was a time he thought that I was competing with him, and there was a time after I moved here, and he was trying to decide what I would be doing and what he'll be doing, because he was not so sure that he was thinking that maybe I will finish before he does. However, the fact is, my facilities are like 5% of what he has. That's another story.
Well, we should go into that now, or we can wait on that.
All right.
Okay.
You want me
you,
to?
You can, or we can come
oh,
back.
Oh, no,
to
yes. It. Well, you know. It is this university. It has to do with the Duke University, what kind of people we bring in the lab. So, you know, kind of people he depends on in his lab and kind of people I depend on in the lab are different. Intellectually, in many ways, they're different. As a result, I realized that at about the same point, what happened is two labs in Harvard, two big professors in Harvard, they saw the thing that we were studying, and they jumped into it too. Ed Harlow's lab and David Livingston's lab, as well as Robert Weinberg's lab. So those are three huge labs, and they started doing same kinds of things. And it was impossible for me to try and think that I might be able to compete with them from a situation where I do not have the resources, I do not have that kind of people in the lab. So that realization was a frustrating realization, because I was in good places. I was in Einstein, I was in Rockefeller, and I never felt that I'm not competitive. I could compete with any lab, anybody, and then get things done faster. In my previous life, when I was in Nevin's lab, I could get things done faster than anybody in Harvard or MIT, doing same kinds of things. Presented work before other people did. But now here, after coming here, I realized it a little late, though. I didn't realize it right away. It took me 3-4 years to realize that's not the case anymore.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll explore this a little bit more later, but when you moved into Nevin's lab, you were moving into a field of viral oncogenes, which was hot, and a lot of people were jumping into the field. This is, right. You know, right. For basic reasons, basic science reasons, but also for the potentials that it might offer in understanding mechanisms of cancer. So I'm going from an entomology lab that you kind of felt was very small and focused on a particular problem to jumping into a field that is very hot and highly competitive. And how did you make that transition from going to what you considered a kind of a complacent and narrow field into one that is, you could argue, is swimming with sharks?
Right, right. How did I do it? The answer has to be short, because it is easy for someone with that kind of training not being able to do this. It is hard work and just trying to reach a goal and the zeal to reach a goal. So that's all I can tell you. I do not consider myself a super intelligent person, because I know I have seen people who are as intelligent as I am doing poorly or better. But I think the zeal to do things, to reach a goal, I think that's, and then staying with it and avoiding all things that interfere with this, even in life, personal life. So everything was secondary in my life.
Okay. Okay, let me flip the tape over.